Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, John Russell, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will bring you part two of The Diamond Lens by Fitz James O'Brien on American Stories. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Nashville, Tennessee is already known to many Americans as Music City. It is famous for country music in the United States and is home to many recording companies. But recently, music recorded for video games, television shows, and movies could earn Nashville a new name, Soundtrack City. The city is known for very good studio musicians. They work mostly on recordings rather than live performances. Musicians in Nashville have helped to make the soundtracks for some of the most popular video games in the U.S. These include Madden, FIFA, Call of Duty, and Star Wars. Also, more production companies have been bringing their film and TV soundtrack recordings to Nashville, including Netflix, Showtime, Sony, and Focus Features. A program the state of Tennessee established last year gives financial support to companies for doing business in the city. Nashville has become one of the two or three major places to record in the world for film, game, and television, Steve Schnurr told the Associated Press. He is president of music for Electronic Arts, or EA, the video game company. In the past, Schnurr worked for MTV and music production companies such as Arista. He also worked as a music supervisor on films before joining EA. "I've been preaching Nashville for some time, and initially it was met with a little cynicism," he said. "Nashville? Don't they make country records there?" For a long time, EA recorded soundtracks for their games with orchestras or large groups of musicians in Los Angeles, London, and Eastern Europe. That changed about 7 years ago when Schnurr came to Nashville to record music for a game called Dragon Age Inquisition. "It was like the world's greatest band," Schnurr said, of the 60-member orchestra gathered for the recording. "It really supported what Nashville is, a collaborative place." Nashville musicians were both fast and skilled, he added. This proved true even on complex songs written by well-known composers such as Hans Zimmer, Lorne Balfe, Jeff Russo, and John Debney. "This is a first-take town," said Schnurr. "You go to Prague, you're doing 6 or 7 takes." Now, Schnurr estimates 90% to 95% of EA's soundtrack music gets recorded in Nashville, with the rest recorded in London. "The music of video games often is very important to the gameplay in creating both emotion and attachment to the storyline." Chris Bowers is the composer behind the award-winning film Green Book. He came to Ocean Way Nashville Recording Studios to record the soundtrack for Madden NFL 20. I think the music immediately connects you, especially when there are strong themes or these melodies that you can't forget. You hear it, and you're immediately transported to your childhood, Bowers said. Bob Rains is executive director of the Tennessee Entertainment Commission. He noted that Tennessee has to compete with neighboring states like Georgia and Louisiana for film and TV production. And music production was what put Tennessee ahead of its competition. Rains notes that the state has the highest concentration of musicians in the U.S. It is second in the country for concentration of sound engineers. About 5 years ago, Rains said they started seeing growth in the soundtrack industry, so the state started working on a program to bring in business. In 6 months, they brought 5 new musical projects to Tennessee that likely would have gone to Eastern Europe, Rains said. The projects were with Netflix, Showtime Networks, Focus Features, Sony, and EA. We have a legacy of music as a state, so it was easy to promote, said Rains. Steve Schnurr said, now the problem is not bringing projects to Nashville. It is finding the time and space to record them. I'm Pete Musto.
Red pandas are native to the high forests of Asia. They are only a little bigger than a house cat and considered to be endangered. Scientists reported last month that not all red pandas belong to the same species. There are 2 different species of this animal, not just one, a study found. The scientists reported finding major differences in 3 genetic markers between Chinese red pandas and Himalayan red pandas. Scientists identified the markers after studying DNA from 65 of the creatures. DNA carries genetic information for the development, growth, and reproduction of living things. Documenting the existence of 2 separate species could help guide efforts for protecting red pandas, scientists added. Chinese red pandas live in northern Myanmar, as well as southeastern Tibet, Sichuan, and Yunnan provinces in China. Himalayan red pandas are native to Nepal, India, Bhutan, and southern Tibet in China, the researchers said. Conservation biologists Yibo Hu and Fu Wen Wei led the study. Their findings were published in the journal Science Advances. To conserve the genetic uniqueness of the 2 species, we should avoid their interbreeding in captivity, Hu said. Interbreeding between species may harm the genetic adaptations already established for their local habitat environment. Scientists had earlier suggested there were 2 species of red panda. But the new study was the first to provide the genetic information necessary to permit such a judgment. International experts estimate a total population of around 10,000 red pandas in the wild. The two species differ in coloration and skull shape. The Himalayan red panda is the rarer of the two. Major threats to red pandas include deforestation and habitat loss. While they have similar names, red pandas and giant pandas are not closely related. Giant pandas are one of the world's 8 bear species. Red pandas are sometimes called living fossils because they have no close living relatives. They are the only remaining member of their mammalian family. I'm John Russell.
This week, we answer a question from a listener in China who asks, what is the difference between sports and sport? Dear VOA fan, that is an interesting question. I'm sure you know that sports can be the plural form of the word sport. You may not know that we can use the word as a verb or adjective. More on that later. The simple answer is that in the United States, we use the noun sport to talk about any contest or game that involves physical activity. When we talk about sports, we mean the plural form of the noun. That is how we talk about basketball, football, and baseball as a group. But if you are in Britain, or you speak British English, you would use the noun sport to talk about the same group of activities. I looked at the BBC News website, and their top menu shows sport for the news about football, cricket, tennis, golf, and so on. Let's look at some examples. My son is a computer programmer. He says, "I am not interested in sports." A British person who shares my son's opinion would say, "I am not interested in sport." When getting to know someone new, a British person may ask, "Do you do any sport?" That does not sound right to my American ears. I would ask, "Do you play any sports?" You can also use the adjective sport to describe something. If you do not make money by fishing, that is, you only fish for fun, you are a sport fisherman. As a verb, sport means to wear something. It is mostly used when someone is wearing something that is attention-getting. He is sporting a bright blue jacket in the photo. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story is called The Diamond Lens. It was written by Fitzjames O'Brien. Today we will hear the second and final part of the story. Here is Morris Joyce with part two of The Diamond Lens.
When I was a child, someone gave me a microscope. I spent hours looking through that microscope, exploring nature's tiny secrets. As I grew up, I became more interested in my microscope than in people. When I was 20 years old, my parents sent me to New York City to study medicine. I never went to any of my classes. Instead, I spent all my time and a lot of my money trying to build the perfect microscope. I wanted to make a powerful lens that would let me see even the smallest parts of life. But all my experiments failed. Then, one day, I met a young man who lived in the apartment above mine. Jules Simon told me about a woman who could speak to the dead. When I visited Madame Volpe's, she let me speak to the spirit of the man who invented the microscope. The spirit of Anton Leeuwenhoek told me how to make a perfect lens from a diamond of 140 carats. But where could I find a diamond that big? When I returned home, I went to Simon's apartment. He was surprised to see me and tried to hide a small object in his pocket. I wanted to discover what it was, so I brought 2 bottles of wine to his apartment. We began to drink. By the time we had finished the first bottle, Simon was very drunk. "Simon, I know you have a secret. Why don't you tell me about it?" Something in my voice must have made him feel safe. He made me promise to keep his secret. Then he took a small box from his pocket. When he opened it, I saw a large diamond shaped like a rose. A pure white light seemed to come from deep inside the diamond. Simon told me he had stolen the diamond from a man in South America. He said it weighed exactly 140 carats. Excitement shook my body. I could not believe my luck. On the same evening that the spirit of Leeuwenhoek tells me the secret of the perfect lens, I find the diamond I need to create it. I decided to steal Simon's treasure. I sat across the table from him as he drank another glass of wine. I knew I could not simply steal the diamond. Simon would call the police. There was only one way to get the diamond. I had to kill Simon. Everything I needed to murder Simon was right there in his apartment. A bottle full of sleeping powder was on a table near his bed. A long, thin knife lay on the table. Simon was so busy looking at his diamond that I was able to put the drug in his glass quite easily. He fell asleep in 15 minutes. I put his diamond in my pocket and carried Simon to the bed. I wanted to make the police think Simon had killed himself. I picked up Simon's long, thin knife and stared down at him. I tried to imagine exactly how the knife would enter Simon's heart if he were holding the knife himself. I pushed the knife deep into his heart. I heard a sound come from his throat, like the bursting of a large bubble. His body moved, and his right hand grabbed the handle of the knife. He must have died immediately. I washed our glasses and took the 2 wine bottles away with me. I left the lights on, closed the door, and went back to my apartment. Simon's death was not discovered until 3 o'clock the next day. one of the neighbors knocked at his door. And when there was no answer, she called the police. They discovered Simon's body on the bed. The police questioned everyone, but they did not learn the truth. The police finally decided Jules Simon had killed himself, and soon everyone forgot about him. I had committed the perfect crime. For 3 months after Simon's death, I worked day and night on my diamond lens. At last, the lens was done. My hands shook as I put a drop of water on a piece of glass. Carefully, I added some oil to the water to prevent it from drying. I turned on a strong light under the glass and looked through the diamond lens. For a moment, I saw nothing in that drop of water, and then I saw a pure white light. Carefully, I moved the lens of my microscope closer to the drop of water. Slowly, the white light began to change. It began to form shapes. I could see clouds and wonderful trees and flowers. These plants were the most unusual colors, bright reds, greens, purples, as well as silver and gold. The branches of these trees moved slowly in a soft wind. Everywhere I looked, I could see fruits and flowers of 1,000 different colors. How strange, I thought, that this beautiful place has no animal life in it. Then I saw something moving slowly among the brightly colored trees and bushes. The branches of a purple and silver bush were gently pushed aside, and there, before my eye, stood the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. She was perfect. Pink skin, large blue eyes, and long golden hair that fell over her shoulders to her knees. She stepped away from the rainbow-colored trees. Like a flower floating on water, she drifted through the air. Watching her move was like listening to the sound of tiny bells ringing in the wind. She went to the rainbow-colored trees and looked up at one of them. The tree moved one of its branches that was full of fruit. It lowered the branch to her, and she took one of the fruits. She turned it in her tiny hands and began to eat. How I wished I had the power to enter that bright light and float with her through those beautiful forests. Suddenly, I realized I had fallen in love with this tiny creature. I loved someone who would never love me back, someone who was a prisoner in a drop of water. I ran out of the room, threw myself on my bed, and cried till I fell asleep. Day after day, I returned to my microscope to watch her. I never left my apartment. I rarely even ate or slept. One day, as usual, I went to my microscope, ready to watch my love. She was there, but a terrible change had taken place. Her face had become thin, and she could hardly walk. The wonderful light in her golden hair and blue eyes was gone. At that moment, I would have given my soul to become as small as she and enter her world to help her. What was causing her to be so sick? She seemed in great pain. I watched her for hours, helpless and alone with my breaking heart. She grew weaker and weaker. The forest also was changing. The trees were losing their wonderful colors. Suddenly, I realized I had not looked at the drop of water for several days. I had looked into it with the microscope, but not at it. As soon as I looked at the glass under the microscope, I understood the horrible truth. I had forgotten to add more oil to the drop of water to stop it from drying. The drop of water had disappeared. I rushed again to look through the lens. The rainbow forests were all gone. My love lay in a spot of weak light. Her pink body was dried and wrinkled. Her eyes were black as dust. Slowly, she disappeared forever. I fainted and woke many hours later on pieces of my microscope. I had fallen on it when I fainted. My mind was as broken as the diamond lens. I crawled to my bed and withdrew from the world. When I finally got better, months later, all my money was gone. People now say I am crazy. They call me Linley, the mad scientist. No one believes I spoke to the spirit of Leeuwenhoek. They laugh when I tell them how I killed Jules Simon and stole his diamond to make the perfect lens. They think I never saw that beautiful world in a drop of water. But I know the truth of the diamond lens, and now so do you.
Just heard The Diamond Lens by FitzJames O'Brien. Listen again next week for another American story told in special English on The Voice of America. This is Shirley Griffith.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is...